listening to Legacy Lawyers, hosted by Michael Haslam and Nathan Croxford.
Of Legacy Lawyers. This is Nathan coming to you with a new guest on our show. I think this is the first time you've ever been on our podcast, right?
It is my first appearance.
So I have with me today Connor Cottle. He is an attorney here at Voyant Legal. And we're going to dive into his origin story. Who is this guy? Why is he here? How did he become part of our team? What makes him tick? All those things. So with that, Connor, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you were before you became an attorney, then maybe what led you to go to law school, anything along the way that's notable or interesting about that, and then we'll kind of go from there and get into what brought you to be with us.
Okay. First off, happy to be here. Love the show. I'm legally obligated to say that. Yeah. Utah native, kind of born and raised around Farmington, Utah. Outside of 3 years when I lived in California as a kid, third, fourth, and fifth grade, which was awesome. But most of my life has been spent in Utah. Particularly around Farmington, which is where our office is. So it's kind of serendipitous that we got together. Mm-hmm. I went to Utah State for my undergraduate degree. And then I decided to do my MBA at Westminster College in Salt Lake. While I was kind of doing that right out of college, I kind of got into finance, specifically financial advising, helping people with retirement planning and investments and stuff. My father was in that industry, so I kind of grew up leaning that way, kind of loving that business. So kind of got my feet wet there and really learned to like working directly with clients and kind of helping them solve, you know, big problems in their lives, right? They might not know anything about that, and you can be that trusted advisor and really help them and provide that service, which, you know, gives me some satisfaction when I can help someone. So that's what I was doing prior to law school. Worked for Morgan Stanley and Merrill Lynch doing advising, really liked it. Ultimately decided there was probably more I could be doing to help people. And when you're thinking of helping people, you think, what are some of the most stressful things in their lives, right? And that can be things like lawsuits, death, you know, those types of things, deaths of family members. And my wife at the time had already decided she wanted to go to PA school. So we were looking at moving out of state. It was going to require a job change anyway, and just decided, you know what, now's the time. We'll just do the starving student thing together. We were able to apply to good programs at the same university. Ended up getting into Quinnipiac University in Connecticut, both of us. So we made the cross-country journey there. And law school was amazing. I loved every minute of it. You know, stressful, but interesting stuff. Never really knew exactly what area of law I wanted to practice in.
Okay.
So I ended up getting divorced in law school, came back to Utah, and having my finance background, the easiest job to get at that time when a job was required was back in finance. So I got a job with Goldman Sachs doing legal compliance work. Goldman's a huge investment bank, very, very stressful situation, a lot of time at the desk, that kind of mentality, which was a great learning experience. You know, my team was all attorneys. It was called the control room, and we dealt with material non-public information, restricted trading lists. We reviewed research. We chaperoned calls and communications between investment banking groups to make sure they weren't running into or mentioning anything they shouldn't. So, but what I missed at that time was kind of working directly with clients. So, and now that I had a job, I was able to kind of sit down and think what I really wanted, right?
Mm-hmm.
Around that time, my family went through some estate planning issues where documents were drafted, but things weren't followed through, or they were amended in the wrong ways. And it led to a lot of kind of personal squabbles, conflict in the family, a lot of unknown. And that kind of piqued my interest in the estate planning world. I helped them with those issues and kind of started to do some research on that area of law. And it kind of really spoke to me. It was kind of that interplay between business, finance, legal. You know, there's various aspects of all of that in estate planning. So around that time, a buddy of mine started a company. Mm-hmm. You want to jump in, Nathan?
I was just going to say, and the interplay between seeing something unfold in your personal life or in your family's personal lives that was difficult, and maybe how things could have been done better or different. And that's always kind of interesting when you see kind of the where the rubber hits the road and the impact it makes on a family.
Yeah. And it was an eye-opening experience, right? Because before that, I mean, all through law school, you learn primarily about, you know, drafting documents, and you get that high level overview of the legal requirements and all those things. But like you said, when the rubber meets the road, when you actually see the effect it has on people, it gives you that added perspective. And what's so funny about, I mean, it just, all of it could have been avoided with the right planning, or if things had been followed through or executed correctly. So it does make, I mean, that type of planning, the proper planning, makes a big difference in how things actually work out. So that was really an interesting experience to see kind of how it worked from start to finish and the effect it can have on people.
Cool. So this is a good time for me to give our disclaimer. We are both estate planning attorneys. This is the area of law that we spend all of our time working in, but the things that are said on this podcast are for education and entertainment purposes only. Edutainment
purposes. Copyright that one.
Only. I would, except I've stolen it from another podcaster. So it's not copyrightable. But anyway, my point was, what we say should not be taken as a substitute for legal advice for your particular situation. Please always seek out a qualified, licensed attorney in your jurisdiction to help you with these matters. That being said, the reason I gave the disclaimer at this point is because I wanted to ask you, drill down a little bit on, when you say things could have been done differently or things could have been avoided, problems could have been avoided, can you talk more about that? And because I think that kind of that speaks to kind of how we do things at this firm. So if you could maybe talk about where you saw the things could have been handled differently, mm-hmm. maybe tie that into how, or to what Voyant Legal does and how you ended up here.
Sure. So one of the things that I saw or experienced personally was, my uncle had a plan in place, but he had amended it a few. So he had a professional plan done, but then he had tried to amend it himself.
Okay.
Through emails and writings and things like that. And he didn't hire an attorney to do those and effectuate that process correctly. So it became a question of what is valid, what met the criteria. It involved a fair amount of money, depending on which way the wind blew on that. So both sides, you know, consulted attorneys, and there was a lot of interpersonal dispute, family dispute, things like that, that kind of persist to this day. So it was just not executed correctly in that case, where if they had come to a qualified attorney, there would have been no doubt, right? Those things would have been done properly, and it wouldn't have been a question at all. It would have just been, here are the wishes, here's what needs to happen. So, and the other issue we saw was,
he passed away. So that's why this became an issue, because he did pass away.
Yep, he did pass away. And when they were looking at his documents, his estate plan, they found some amendments that he had just kind of done himself.
Okay.
So, yeah. And, you know, it was a family thing. So neither party really wanted to litigate anything. They just wanted an answer. So, you know, the court wasn't involved and it was just kind of, we'll concede, one side conceded to the other side versus taking them to court and things like that.
You say that as if that's how families normally work. I'd say your family is an outlier in that regard because,
yeah.
In our experience, and I don't know what your experience was before Voyant and after joining, but family members, I've seen lots of family members that will sue at the drop of a hat. They have no problem with that concept.
And that's certainly been my experience too. I mean, anytime we're talking about money, right?
Yeah.
That is a possibility. Money does change the way people think, especially at a time when they're grieving, right? Everyone grieves in a different way. They handle that differently. Especially if it's like a parent or someone really large in their life, who knows how they're going to react. So I think they were more of an outlier.
That's good. It's
definitely been my experience that they're not afraid to go to the mat when money's involved. So that didn't happen in my case, but it very well could have.
That's good, or I should say it can be good, because the other thing I've seen is sometimes there are people that they don't want to sue, and it's more a function of, well, it's either that they don't want to destroy the family relationship, or I've seen scenarios where there really is no love lost and there's already some pretty strong animosity, but one of the parties is not willing to get down and roll around in the mud with whoever is willing to do that. Mm-hmm. And so rather than engage in that, they just walk away and they end up getting taken advantage of. So
right. That
can be good and it can be bad.
Hopefully
that was not what happened in your family, but anyway, go ahead.
No, I think you hit the nail on the head perfectly there. My experience has definitely been that people will go to the mat, and there's usually one part, if it doesn't go that way, there's one party who just decides, you know, for the sake of the family, or I don't want to deal with this, or whatnot, they just kind of will allow themselves to be taken advantage of for the sake of calm, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's definitely been my experience as well through that. The other issue was kind of clarity, right? The documents weren't drafted in a clear way where it was clearly understood what the wishes were. And so that raised questions as well. People interpreted it different. And that's one of the things I like that we do is we work very hard to make everything clear cut, right? Very easy to understand and explainable, so that a trustee can step in and just follow those wishes and they're not saying, well, what does this mean? What, I don't know what they really want here.
Right.
So I've seen that with other estate plans. So I like that we work really hard to avoid that problem.
Okay, cool. So one of the things that we kind of built this firm around when Mike and I, when we connected up in 2013-ish. Mike had been out he'd been practicing for a year or so and had was working as a solo at that point in time. And then it's a long story, and I think we've told that story in our origin podcast episodes. But when we joined forces, and at that point in time, the law firm was called Haslam Law. And we talked a lot about how we wanted things to work when it became a partnership. And one of the things we did not want was the Haslam Croxford naming convention, the typical lawyer naming convention, because we wanted this to be something that wasn't necessarily just about us, but was about a team. And we also, at least I'll say for my part, I'm not the kind of guy that plans to practice and pass away in front of my desk.
Sure.
It could still happen, but that's not my objective. I know attorneys that they plan to work till the day they die, because they just, that's how they're built. I didn't want to do that, and I don't think Mike did either. And so the idea is that we want this thing to continue on, and we can't have our names attached to it permanently like that if that's the idea. So we wanted to be able to have this thing continue on, because for reasons like what you've just mentioned, when somebody needs help, maybe I'm retired, maybe somebody's moved on, but we still want our clients to be able to pick up the phone and call that same phone number and be able to reach the same trusted advisor or the same team with the same philosophy that they were accustomed to when they first did their planning. And one of the pillars of the firm when we rebranded to be Voyant Legal was we wanted to be trusted advisors for our clients, as opposed to just kind of glorified paper salesmen who are, you know, putting together fancy binders full of hard to read documents and selling those to people and moving on. So maybe talk about if you had any experience with other practices, and how things were done, and then what have you noticed about that kind of trusted advisor philosophy and how it works here?
Sure. And first, to the listeners out there, a fun fact about Nathan is he doesn't sit at his desk. He stands. So if he goes down, I'm one office over. We're all going to hear him fall. We'll be right there to help him. So don't worry about Nathan.
That's a good point. And I am standing as we speak.
He's a stander all the time. So I don't know how he does it. But to the trusted advisor point, that was really drilled into me kind of by my dad, as he was a financial advisor and then a manager. And that's big in the advisory business, right? You don't want to be just another person that can get someone information. You want them to come to you with questions and that have confidence in you as that trusted advisor. So you really got to step up your game and be communicative and educated on the subject matter and all that, and then just really work with them when they need you to work with them. So I kind of saw that there, and I tried to carry that into my financial advisory practice. And really, I mean, it's such a bigger extension in the law, right? Because a lot of people for advising, they can get a stock quote anywhere now. You can go online, you can get all that stuff there. For legal advice, I mean, a lot of what's out there is crap or misleading. So it's really important that we be that trusted advisor so they can come to us and know that the information we're giving them is current and accurate and they can rely upon it. So I try to carry that into my every conversation with clients. And that's one of the reasons I actually joined Voyant, was because other firms that I had run across were paper mills, like you said, right? They want to sell you the document and then get you out of their office. If you have questions, you know, they're going to bill you in that 7-minute increment. So you're less likely to go to them with questions. After talking to you and Mike and Lance and the other members of the team, you know, we want people to call us. We want questions. We want to be there for our clients and for the children of our clients. If they pick up that binder, if the worst happens and they don't know what to do, and they, you know, who do we call? Our number's right there. We'll help you. Yeah. So that's one of the things that really drew me to Voyant, was that above and beyond approach to be that trusted advisor.
Do you know why your uncle, I'm just wondering if had he been working with a firm that kind of had more of that trusted advisor philosophy, do you feel like that would have been, that he would have been more likely to get proper guidance and maybe not have been doing things on his own? Or was he just one of these guys that he's going to DIY it no matter what?
You know, he didn't DIY the plan to begin with. So he had a relationship with an attorney, and for whatever reason, he didn't want to call them for the amendments. So he clearly had no problem working with them at the outset. And in my mind, that attorney, if he had built the relationship and been that trusted advisor, he would have called him, right? He would have had no problem going to him and saying, hey, I want to make these changes. Let's do that. How do we do it? It wouldn't have been a problem in my mind if had that trusted advisor relationship with the attorney.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, and the reason I ask that is because, I mean, I can think of just in the last, oh, I don't know, what are we, I can't believe it's already May, but
yeah,
just in the first 4 months of this year alone, I can count probably 5 or 6 clients, five or six clients that came to see us with existing plans that, and these are just cases I've worked on. You may have had the same experience. We have other attorneys at the firm that probably have had the same experience. They have an existing plan and they come to us and they say, and one of my first questions is always, well, why, you know, in one form or another, I'll ask the question, try to be delicate about it, but why are you not working with the attorney that created the plan in the first place? Mm-hmm. And there's a theme that runs through those responses. And it's that I've heard everything from, we didn't feel like he was very friendly, or we didn't feel like she had the time for us. Like, it seemed like she was put out that we were calling and asking questions, or the guy, I didn't, you know, I've heard him say, I didn't feel like he necessarily knew what he was doing, or I didn't trust this attorney. Mm-hmm. So there's kind of, I think there's a lot of that out there, unfortunately. And so I think what we want our listeners to take from our podcast, and probably something that we hammer on every single time we're on, is how important that trusted advisor relationship is. Because they're good attorneys, technically sound attorneys that know how to put together good documents, and they know the ins and outs of planning. They do a good job at what they do. But I think what you have to be cognizant of, that's a mouthful, and kind of focused on is, you know, does the person that you're working with, the firm, the attorney, the team, do they have, as part of their, you know, process, or as part of their firm philosophy, do they have, do they create an expectation with you right off the bat that there's going to be an ongoing dialogue, that there's going to be additional contacts, that they want, are they encouraging you to contact them? Are they making it known that, you know, this is the best way to get a hold of us? In our case, we set aside an hour, each attorney sets aside, and some of our paralegals even set aside an hour a day to return phone calls and emails, because if you're not accessible and you're not responsive, then people they're not going to engage with you. The other thing is, you mentioned this, the billing in 6-minute increments. I've done litigation in the past. People aren't dumb. Like, if every time they pick up the phone and call you, or every time they send an email, they subsequently get a bill for $85 or $110 or whatever it is for an 8 to 12 minute phone call or an email response, they're going to stop communicating with you. So
right,
if you're not, it's one thing to say you want to be a trusted advisor. The question is, do you back that up with, do you really make yourself accessible? Mm-hmm. Are you making, are you giving the client an easy way to get in touch with you? Are you being responsive? That kind of thing. So I think it matters, as people are going out and trying to find an attorney to work with, it matters that they, you know, focus on that. Are they going to be a good trusted advisor for you and your family? Or are they just somebody that's going to help put a pile of paper in your hands and usher you on your way?
Right.
So,
yeah, no, I've had that same experience with people coming in, and I do ask, you know, why are you reaching out to us and not the creator of these documents? And I get some of those same responses, right? You've been doing it a lot longer than I have, so I'm sure you've heard, you know, everything there is about that. but I, you know, you hear that they didn't really seem interested in helping me, or that attorney wasn't there anymore. And then that's all they told me. No one else offered to help. No one, you know, was just, they're not here anymore. See you later. So there was certainly no relationship there. And if the attorneys had kind of hammered in that it's the organization, right? Like, I might be your attorney, but if I go out and get hit by a bus tomorrow, there's still going to be someone here to answer your questions and be in your corner. And I think that's something I try to hammer home, that it's the whole team, right?
Yeah, for sure. And that's, and I think it's important that that team approach, it matters, because and that's kind of to my point of earlier, you know, when we decided what to name the firm and kind of how we were going to structure it. We wanted to make sure that if something happened to either one of us or both of us, or, you know, down the road, that we didn't create the same type of experience that too many of our clients have already previously had. Where, because the other thing I hear a lot is, well, he retired or she died, or they're just, and because there was no succession plan or, you know, plan for the future, clients are just left with a phone number that doesn't ring to anything anymore. And then they really feel like they don't have the guidance they need. They're kind of out in the cold and they don't know what to do. So that can be stressful.
Definitely.
All right. Well, anything else about you that we should know as far as what makes you tick? You gave an interesting fact about me. I stand at my desk. Tell us something interesting about Connor.
Interesting about me. I'm an avid golfer. I love to play golf. That might be interesting or might be one of the most boring facts ever, depending on your thoughts about golf. So take that as it is. But I love to play golf. I love to watch golf. I've been lucky to go to, you know, some major tournaments. The British Open at St. Andrews, the Masters, U.S. Open. The only one I've never been to is a PGA Championship, so I've got to do that to get the viewer version of the Rory Slam.
If you had a private jet, you might still make part of the first round, right?
I know. They're starting today. Yeah. Are you rooting for your guy Bryson?
Yeah, I am.
Yeah. One day you and I are going to have a serious conversation about Bryson.
Okay. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Do you keep a handicap?
I do. Right now it's a 5.5. I have not been playing as much this year because of, you know, work and all that. But so we'll see if I can maintain that throughout the year, knock on wood.
Man, that's amazing. That's a level of golf that I can't even dream of being able to attain. So,
and you know,
you must have some natural talent, because I don't think just anybody can become a single digit handicapper.
I've played a lot of golf, and it's been a really long time I've been playing, and I've done all the lessons thing. I've done the practice thing. So I think that helped build that base. Some days I play to it, and some days you're like, this guy's never picked up a golf club in his life, you know, depending on the day. So, you know, it is what it is. That's golf. But I do love the game.
Do you feel like that becoming a single digit is within the reach of just anybody, or do you have to have some natural talent to be able to pull that off?
I think golf mainly, in my opinion, is a mental game, right? Most for amateurs, guys like us, right? Most of the time we're not hitting the ball perfectly. So you can't have that expectation that you're going to be perfect. So you've just got to go out and play the game versus worrying about how the swing looks or if it's being executed exactly perfect, right? Some of my lowest rounds have been when I'm not hitting the ball the best. And it's just that I've got to figure out a way to score well anyway kind of mentality. So it's very much a mental game. And I think because it's a mental game, anyone can get better at it, right? That you don't have to be tall or strong or things like that to play well. So I think it's definitely within everybody if they want to put in the time and the effort to be good at it. It just takes the time and the practice to do it. Guys like, I mean, the pros, those guys are naturally gifted, right? So to get to that level, you've got to have some of that. You've either got to have some strength or some ridiculous flexibility that can, so you can pound the ball and be competitive there. But for the everyday golfer to get better, it's a mind game.
Yeah, I should probably spend some time. We should talk golf because I like, I love it. I like to play. I'm nowhere near that level. Like I've never kept a handicap, never played enough to keep a handicap. I would like to do that. So maybe that's part of our, after you get done browbeating me for my Bryson proclivity, you can maybe share some useful information.
Absolutely.
Connor,
I'm not browbeating you for Bryson. Bryson has certainly earned everything he's achieved. I can't take anything away from the guy.
So we probably have lost a good portion of our audience at this stage. They're like, these guys just like geeked out, went on this left-hand turn.
Yeah.
But I'm going to keep going for just a bit because for those that did stay, funny story. Connor had, we'd had some changes in the team and he was moving offices. And the day I come in, with a brand new Crushers hat. So for anybody that's not familiar, I'm not a huge, just to go on the record, like literally to go on the record, I'm not a huge LIV fan. So LIV is a breakaway tour. It's I think it's a Saudi financed, although golf is going to, maybe everything is going to be Saudi financed at this point.
It sounds
PGA,
like
PGA is also going to be taking money from Saudi. So anyway, breakaway tour, Greg Norman was kind of the first CEO or whatever commissioner. And then a bunch of players went out and they were offered these massive, massive sums of money to leave the PGA tour and help create this competitor tour, this disruptor tour, whatever you want to call it. I'm not necessarily a fan of even the format, but I am a fan of Bryson, especially given the two U.S. Open wins. So Bryson DeChambeau is this freak of a human being that can, I mean, Crushers is the best. So on the LIV tour, they actually have teams and they have team names. So I had just picked up a Bryson hat. So it's a Crushers hat. And I walk in. And as I walk in, it was on a Saturday of all things. I walk in to do something, and I think you were in here with your wife. What's her name?
Haley.
Haley. And you had just, he was decorating his new office, and up on the wall is a picture, a montage, a photo montage of the famous U.S. Open win at Pinehurst number 2, where Payne Stewart beat Phil Mickelson in a really tightly contested final round and won the U.S. Open. And then he was subsequently sadly killed in a plane crash that happened not even a year after that. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I walk in, I'm looking at this thing he's just hung. I mean, one of the things that I thought maybe we could connect on, and boy, was I wrong, was that, During that entire Bryson run the last U.S. Open that was held, also at Pinehurst number 2, where Payne Stewart won that tournament. Bryson is a big fan of Payne Stewart and wore a Payne Stewart pin on the back of his hat the entire tournament. So I thought we could connect on that Bryson, and man, you got to understand that I'm like maybe five and a half with dress shoes on. I weigh 160 pounds soaking wet. Connor's like 6'8". What are you? I'm kidding.
6'3".
6'3", 6'8". When you're 5'5", 6'3", and 6'8", doesn't feel much different, right? So he's looking down at me and I was like, that's awesome. I was looking at the photo montage he framed and put on the wall. And he's looking at me like he wants to like rip this hat off my head. And
that's not true.
And I said something like, well, and I'm wearing my Bryson hat. And his response was, and I'm trying not to hold that against you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so, here I am, right? Like you're a partner, right? I can't be saying anything bad to you, negative. I can't be disparaging your attire.
Okay. So first of all, I am the kind of person that, yes, you absolutely can. And I am not the kind of person that's going to retaliate in some fashion if you disagree with my fashion sense or you dislike the golfer that I cheer for. Mm-hmm. So you would have been just fine. I thought it was funny that you were willing to say, and I'm trying not to hold it against you. Anyway, we haven't gotten to the bottom of this. We maybe will have to do a follow-up episode where we talk about something related to the law.
Right.
But then give the three people that care about this, the last 5-10 minutes of this discussion, an update on how we managed to hash that out.
Well, I can tell you it's going to be easy because you said my issue with Bryson is mainly live golf related. So the fact that you're not a huge champion of live golf, they've done some good things.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've found common ground here.
Okay. All right.
So I think we're more on the same team than we realize.
Yeah. And I agree that, I mean, cause what you said that day, and then we got to wrap this up. Cause this is Lance is going to be like, guys, we got to lose the whole last 15.
Yeah. We're going to have to redo podcast. This.
No, it's fine. I was going to say the one thing that you said, that I agree with. And the thing that I said that I think you agreed with is, that I don't think it was a good idea to pay these guys we're talking like hundreds of millions of dollars, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just to join the tour. And then the prize money on the LIV tour is just stupid high. Like,
right.
You win one of these tournaments, you would never really have to play again. And some of these guys that have joined, I would use Cam. Oh, I always get the Cam Smith. Cameron Young and Cameron Smith. I get them confused, but Cameron Smith, the Aussie with the weird mullet, mm-hmm. He was super fun to watch when he was on the PGA Tour. And then he took the big money and he's just coasting. He doesn't care. He doesn't try to compete in the majors. That's the thing about Bryson is I don't think he's ever changed how he approaches the game on either tour. He's still hungry when he's at the majors. He wants to win big tournaments. So, and you made a point that there's something to be said for guys that have to come up through the ranks and grind it out.
They got to earn it in the dirt, right?
And you got to earn it in the dirt is what you said. And I totally agree with that. So,
yeah. And I do think Bryson is one of the exceptions there where I think he still pushes. He still tries to get better. He's still competitive. He's the best case example for a live golfer still being competitive,
but also maybe really the only person that's managed to pull that off, right? So
yeah, he's definitely the top performer there. I mean, Koepka can still be competitive just because he's an ultra competitive guy, but mm-hmm. Bryson's the use case for live golf working.
Yeah. Okay, well, sorry for the geek out on golf and on the competing tours. We are super excited to have Connor at our firm, and he has been doing outstanding work with our clients. He's fit in really well with our culture. And I guess we'll just finish up by reminding you once again that it matters who you work with in this arena, in this area of law. You want to look for someone who specializes. You want to look for someone who is client focused, client-centered, client-centric, however you want to say that. Somebody who wants to interact with you, that enjoys that aspect. I always tell my clients that my favorite part of what I do is not the standing at my desk cranking out documents or, the technical aspect. I always enjoy what I'm doing most when I'm interacting with my clients and I feel like we have a good time. We get good work done, and I welcome those opportunities. So, mm-hmm. In that regard, Connor's fitting in just perfectly with us, and we're super glad to have him. Thanks for coming on today. And
hey, thanks for having me.
Giving us your origin story, and we are excited for all the good things we have in the future.
I am as well. Thanks all for having me.
Thanks, everybody, for joining us, and we'll catch you on the next one.
You've been listening to Legacy Lawyers with Michael Haslam and Nathan Croxford. We give you the juicy detail of cases that our law firm has dealt with. We take out the lawyer talk and legalese and show you what options some of our clients had to choose from to fix their situation. The effects of not doing planning can be devastating. We'll be back soon, but in the meantime, hook up with us on Facebook and Instagram at Voyant Legal. Call us at 801-951-0500 or send us an email at team@voyantlegal.com. And for commonly asked questions, hit voyantlegal.com/resources. We'll see you next time.